Side 9, The Diamond Throne, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 389. "Fly, little sister," she told the fairy, and the tiny creature soared once again into the air. "We'll be going now, Tanjin," she said. Sparhawk started to object, but she laid one restraining hand on his arm and started toward the door.
"What are you going to do about that?" Tanjin cried, pointing at the circling fairy.
"Do?" Sophronia said. "Why, nothing, Doctor. She's quite happy here. Feed her sugar from time to time and put out a small dish of water for her. In return, she'll sing for you. Don't try to catch her, though. That would make her very angry."
"You can't leave her here," he exclaimed in anguish. "If anyone sees her here, I'll be burned at the stake for witchcraft."
"He sees directly to the central point, doesn't he?" Sophronia said to Sparhawk. "The scientific mind is noted for that." Sparhawk grinned. "Shall we go then?"
"Wait!"
Tanjin cried. "Was there something you wanted to tell us, Doctor?" Sophronia asked mildly.
"All right, all right. But you must swear to keep it a secret that I told you this."
"Of course. Our lips are sealed." Tanjin drew in a deep breath and scurried to the curtained doorway to make certain that no one was listening outside. Then he turned and motioned them into a far corner where he spoke in a hoarse whisper.
"Diristim is so virulent that there's no natural remedy or antidote," he began.
"That's what Voldy told us," Sparhawk said.
"You'll note that I said no natural remedy or antidote," Tanjin continued. "Some years ago, in the course of my studies, I came across a very old and curious book. It predated Ishan's time, and it had been written before his prohibitions came into effect. It seems that the primitive healers here in Rendor routinely utilized magic in treating their patients. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. But they effected some astonishing cures. The practice had one common element. There are a number of objects in the world which have enormous power. The physicians of antiquity used that sort of thing to cure their patients."
"I see," Sophronia said. "Styric healers sometimes resort to the same desperate measure."
"The practice is quite common in the Tamil Empire on the Daurasian continent," Tanjin went on, "but it's fallen into disfavor here in Ayosia. Ayosian physicians prefer scientific techniques. They're more reliable, for one thing, and Alines have always been suspicious of magic. But Diristim is so potent that none of the customary antidotes have any effect. Magical objects are the only possible cure."
"And what did you use to cure the king's brother and nephews?" Sophronia asked.
"It was an uncut gem of a peculiar color. I think it originally came from Daurasia, though I can't really be sure. It's my belief that the Tamil gods infused it with their power."
"And where is that gem now?" Sparhawk asked intently.
"Gone, I'm afraid. I had to grind it to a powder and mix it with wine to cure the king's relatives."
"You idiot!" Sophronia exploded. "That is not the way to use such an object. You need only touch it to the patient's body and call forth its power."
"I'm a trained physician, madam," he replied stiffly. "I cannot turn insects into fairies, nor levitate myself, nor cast spells upon my enemies. I can only follow the normal practices of my profession, and that means that the patient must ingest the medication."
"You destroyed a stone that might have healed thousands for the sake of just a few."
With some effort, she controlled her anger. "Do you know of any other such objects?" she asked him.
"A few," he shrugged. "There's a great spear in the Imperial Palace in Tamil, several rings in Zamok, though I doubt that they'd be much good in healing people. It's rumored that there's a jeweled bracelet in Pelosia somewhere, but that might be only a myth. The sword of the king of the island of Mithrium was reputed to have great power, but Mithrium sank into the sea eons ago. I've also heard that the Styrix have quite a few magic wands."
"That's also a myth," she told him. "Wood is too fragile for that kind of power." "Any others?"
"The only one I know of is the jewel on the royal crown of Thalesia, but that's been lost since the time of the Zamok invasion."
He frowned.
"I don't think this will help very much," he added, "but Arasham has a talisman that he claims is the most holy and powerful thing in all the world. I've never seen it myself, so I can't say for sure. And Arasham's wits aren't so firmly set in his head that he'd be any kind of an authority. You'd never be able to get it away from him in any case. Sophrenia reattached her veil across the lower part of her face.
Thank you for your candor, Dr. Tangen, she said. Be assured that no one will learn of your secret from us.
She thought a moment. I think you should splint this, she said, holding out her arm. That should prove to the curious that we had a legitimate reason for this visit, and it should protect you as well as us.
That's a very good idea, madam.
Tangen fetched a couple of slats and a long strip of white cloth. Would you take a bit of friendly advice, Tangen? Sparhawk asked him as he began to splint Sophrenia's arm.
I'll listen.
Do that. If it were me, I'd gather up a few things and go to Zand. The king can protect you there. Get out of Dabur while you still can. Fanatics make the jump from suspicion to certainty very easily, and it won't do you much good if you're proved innocent after you've been burned at the stake.
But everything I own is here.
I'm sure that'll be a great comfort to you when your toes are on fire.
Do you really think I'm in that much danger?
Tangen asked in a weak voice, looking up from his task. Sparhawk nodded. That much and more. I'd estimate that you'll be lucky to live out the week if you stay here in Dabur. The doctor began to tremble violently as Sophrenia slipped her splinted arm back into the sling.
Wait a minute,
he said as they started toward the door.
What about that?
He pointed at the fairy swooping through the air near the window.
Oh, Sophrenia said. Sorry, I almost forgot about her.
She mumbled a few words and made a vague gesture. The bumblebee went back to batting its head against the window. It was dark when they emerged from the apothecary's shop into the nearly deserted square. It's not very much, Sparhawk said dubiously.
It's more than we had before. At least we know how to cure Alana. All we need to do now is to find one of these objects.
Would you be able to tell if Arasham's talisman has any real power?
I think so.
Good. Arane says that Arasham preaches every night. Let's go find him. I'll listen to a dozen sermons if it puts me close to a cure.
How do you propose to get it away from him?
I'll think of something. A black-robed man suddenly blocked their path. Stop right there, he commanded. What's your problem, neighbor? Sparhawk asked him. Why are you not at the feet of Holy Arasham? The robed man asked accusingly. We were just on our way, Sparhawk replied. All Dabur knows that Holy Arasham speaks to the multitudes at sundown. Why are you deliberately absenting yourselves? We arrived only today, Sparhawk explained, and I had to seek medical attention for my sister's injured arm. The fanatic scowled suspiciously at Sophrenia's sling. Surely you did not consult with the wizard Tangen, he said in an outraged tone.
When one is in pain, one does not ask to see the healer's credentials, Sophrenia told him. I can assure you, however, that the doctor used no witchcraft. He set the broken bone and splinted it for me in the same way any other physician would have.
The righteous do not consort with wizards, the zealot declared stubbornly. I'll tell you what, neighbor, Sparhawk said pleasantly. Why don't I break your arm? Then you can visit the doctor yourself. If you watch him very closely, you should be able to tell if he's using witchcraft or not. The fanatic stepped back apprehensively. Come now, friend, Sparhawk told him enthusiastically. Be brave. It won't hurt all that much. And think of how much Holy Arasham will appreciate your zeal in rooting out the abomination of witchcraft.
Could you tell us where we might find the place where Holy Arasham speaks to the multitudes? Sophrenia interposed. Our souls hunger and thirst for his words.
Over that way, the nervous man said, pointing. You can see the light from the torches. Thanks, friend, Sparhawk said, bowing slightly. He frowned. How is it that you yourself are not at the services this evening?
I have a sterner duty, the fellow declared. I must seek out those who are absent without cause and deliver them up for judgment.
Ah, Sparhawk said. I see. He turned away, then turned back. Are you sure you wouldn't like to have me break your arm for you? It won't take but a minute.
The fanatic hurried away from them. Must you threaten everyone you meet?
Sparhawk? Sophronia asked.
He irritated me.
You irritate very easily, don't you? He considered it.
Yes, he admitted. I suppose I do. Shall we go?
They went through the dark streets of Dabur until they reached the tents pitched on the outskirts. Some distance toward the south, a ruddy glow pulsed up toward the glittering stars. They moved quietly past the tents toward the light. The flickering torches were set on tall poles surrounding a kind of natural amphitheater on the southern edge of town, a sort of depression between two hills. The hollow was filled with Arasham's followers, and the deranged holy man himself stood atop a large boulder halfway up the side of one of the hills. He was tall and gaunt, with a long gray beard and bushy black eyebrows. His voice was strident as he harangued his followers, but his words were difficult to understand because of his lack of teeth. When Sparhawk and Sophronia joined the crowd, the old man was in the middle of an extended and highly involuted proof of God's special favor, which had, he declared, been bestowed upon him in a dream. There were huge logical gaps in his argument, and great leaps of what passed for faith here in Rendor. "Is he making any sense at all?" Sophronia whispered to Sparhawk in a puzzled tone as she removed the splints on the sling.
"Not that I can detect," he whispered back.
"I didn't think so. Does the Aline God actively encourage that sort of hysterical gibberish?"
"He never has to me."
"Can we get any closer?"
"I don't think so. The crowd's pretty thick in front of where he's standing."
Arasham then turned to one of his favorite topics, a denunciation of the church. The organized Aline religion, he maintained, was cursed by God for its failure to recognize his exalted status as the chosen and beloved spokesman of the Most High.
"But the wicked shall be punished,"
he lisped in a toothless shriek with spittle flying from his lips.
"My followers are invincible. Be patient for but a little more time, and I will raise my holy talisman and lead you into war against them. They will send their accursed church knights to do war upon us, but fear them not. The power of this holy relic will sweep them before us like chaff before the wind."
He held something high over his head in his tightly clenched fist.
"The spirit of the blessed Ishand himself has confirmed this to me."
"Well?" Sparhawk whispered to Sophronia.
"He's too far away," she murmured. "I can't feel anything one way or the other. We're going to have to get closer. I can't even tell what he's holding."
Arasham's voice sank into a harshly conspiratorial tone.
"I tell you this, O ye faithful, and my words are true. The voice of God has revealed to me that even now our movement is spreading through the fields and forests of the kingdoms of the north. The ordinary people there, our brothers and sisters, grow weary of the yoke of the church, and they will join our holy cause."
"It was Martell who told him that," Sparhawk muttered. "And if he thinks that Martell is the voice of God, then he's even crazier than I thought."
He rose up on his tiptoes and looked over the heads of the crowd. A large pavilion stood some distance down the hill from where Arasham was preaching. It was surrounded by a palisade of stout poles.
"Let's work our way around this crowd," he suggested. "I think I've located the old man's tent."
Slowly they moved back until they were at the edge of the crowd. Arasham continued his rambling harangue, but his slurred words were lost in the distance and the murmuring of his followers. Sparhawk and Sophronia slipped around the crowd toward the palisade and the dark pavilion inside it. When they were perhaps 20 paces away, Sparhawk touched Sophronia's arm, and they stopped. A number of armed men stood before the opening at the front of the palisade.
"We'll have to wait until he finishes preaching," Sparhawk murmured.
"Would you like to tell me what you have in mind?" she said. "I hate surprises."
"I'm going to see if I can get us into his tent. If that talisman of his really has any power, it might be difficult to get it away from him in the middle of this crowd."
"How do you propose to manage that, Sparhawk?"
"I thought I'd try flattery."
"Isn't that a bit dangerous and very obvious?"
"Of course it's obvious, but you have to be obvious when you're dealing with deranged people. They don't have the concentration to grasp subtlety."
Arasham's voice was rising to a shrill climax, and his followers cheered at the end of each of his mumbled pronouncements. Then he delivered his benediction, and the crowd began to break up.
Surrounded by a knot of jealous disciples, the holy man began to walk slowly through the milling throng toward his tent. Sparhawk and Sophrenia moved to place themselves in his path.
"Stand aside," one of the disciples commanded harshly.
"Forgive me, exalted disciple," Sparhawk said loudly enough for his words to carry to the tottering old man, "but I bear a message from the King of Deira for Holy Arashim. His Majesty sends greetings to the true head of the Aline Church."
Sophrenia made a slightly strangled noise.
"Holy Arashim takes no note of kings," the disciple sneered arrogantly. "Now stand aside."
"A moment there, Ikad,"
Arashim mumbled in a surprisingly weak voice.
"We would hear more of this message from our brother of Deira. It may well be that this is the communication mentioned by God when last he spoke with us."
"Most holy Arashim," Sparhawk said with a deep bow, "His Majesty, King Obler of Deira, greets you as his brother. Our king is very old, and age always brings wisdom."
"Truly,"
Arashim agreed, stroking his own long gray beard.
"His Majesty has long contemplated the teachings of the Blessed Ashand," Sparhawk continued, "and he has also eagerly followed your own career here in Rendor. He has regarded the activities of the church with increasing disfavor. He has found churchmen to be hypocritical and self-serving."
"My very words,"
Arashim said ecstatically.
"I have said so myself 100 times and more."
"His Majesty acknowledges that you are the source and wellspring of his thought, Holy Arashim."
"Well,"
Arashim replied, preening himself slightly, "His Majesty believes that the time has come for a purification of the Aline Church, and he further believes that you are the one who has been chosen by God to purge the church of her sins."
"Did you hear my sermon tonight?"
the old man asked eagerly.
"I preached to that self-same topic."
"Truly," Sparhawk said, "I was amazed at how closely your words coincided with those of His Majesty when he charged me with his message to you. Know, however, Holy Arashim, that His Majesty intends to provide more aid to you than the mere comfort of his greetings and his respectful affection. The details of his further intentions, though, must be for your ears alone." He looked around suspiciously at the crowd pressing in upon them. "In a gathering so large as this, there may be several who are not what they seem, and if what I have to tell you should reach Kyrolos, the church would bend all her efforts to hinder His Majesty's design." Arashim tried without much success to look shrewd.
"Your prudence becomes you, young man," he agreed. "Let us go into my pavilion so that you may more fully disclose the mind of my dear brother Obler to me."
Pushing aside the officious disciples, Sparhawk thrust his way through their ranks to offer the support of his arm and shoulder to the elderly zealot.
"Holy one," he said in a fawning tone, "fear not to lean upon me, for as the Blessed Ashand has commanded, it is the duty of the young and strong to serve the aged and wise."
"How truly you speak, my son."
They passed thus through the gate of the palisade and across a stretch of sand dotted with sheep droppings. The interior of Arashim's pavilion was far more luxurious than might have been expected from its severe exterior. A single lamp burned expensive oil in the center, and priceless carpets covered the rude sand floor. Silken fabric curtained off the rearward portions of the pavilion, and from behind those curtains came the giggling of adolescent boys.
"Please sit and take your ease,"
Arashim invited expansively, sinking down upon a cluster of silken cushions.
"Let us take some refreshment, and then you may tell me of the intent of my dear brother Obler of Deira."
He clapped his hands sharply together, and a doe-eyed boy emerged from behind one of the silken panels.
"Bring us some of the fresh melons, Sabud,"
Arashim told him.
"As you command, most holy."
The boy bowed and retired behind the silken screen. Arashim leaned back on his cushions.
"I am not at all surprised at the communication you have brought me concerning the growing sentiment for our cause in Deira,"
he lisped to Sparhawk.
"Word has reached me that such feelings are not uncommon in the kingdoms of the north. Indeed, another such message has but recently arrived."
He paused thoughtfully.
"It occurs to me, perhaps at the prompting of God himself, whoever joins his thought with mine,
that you and the other messenger may know each other." He turned toward a silken panel that concealed a dimly lighted part of the tent. "Come forth, my friend and adviser. Look upon the face of our noble visitor from Deira, and tell me if you know him." A shadow moved behind the panel. It seemed to hesitate for a moment, and then a robed and hooded figure emerged into the lamplight. The hooded man was only slightly shorter than Sparhawk, and he had the heavy shoulders of a warrior. He reached up and pushed back his hood to reveal his piercing black eyes and his thick mane of snowy white hair. In a kind of curious detachment, Sparhawk wondered what it was exactly that kept him from instantly drawing his sword.
"Indeed, most holy Arasham," Martell said in his deep, resonant voice. "Sparhawk and I have known each other for a long time."
Chapter 23.
"It's been a long time, hasn't it, Sparhawk?" Martell said in a neutral tone. His eyes, however, were watchful. With some effort, Sparhawk relaxed his tightly clenched muscles. "Yes, it has," he replied. "It must be 10 years now, at least. We should try to get together more often." "We'll have to make a point of that." It hung there. The two continued to look directly into each other's faces. The air seemed to crackle with tension as each waited for the other to make the first move.
"Sparhawk," Arasham mused. "A most unusual name. It seems to me that I've heard it somewhere before."
"It's a very old name," Sparhawk told him. "It's been passed down through my family for generations. Some of my ancestors were men of note."
"Perhaps that's where I heard it then,"
Arasham mumbled complacently.
"I'm delighted to have been able to reunite two old and dear friends."
"We are forever in your debt, most holy," Martell replied. "You cannot imagine how I've hungered for the sight of Sparhawk's face." "No more than I hungered for the sight of yours," Sparhawk said. He turned to the ancient lunatic. "At one time Martell and I were almost as close as brothers, most holy. It's a shame that the years have kept us apart." "I've tried to find you, Sparhawk," Martell said coolly, "several times." "Yes, I heard about that. I always hurried back to the place where you'd been seen, but by the time I got there, you'd already left." "Pressing business," Martell murmured.
"It is ever thus,"
Arasham lisped sententiously, his ruined mouth collapsing over the words.
"The friends of our youth slip away from us, and we are left alone in our old age."
His eyes dropped shut in melancholy reverie. He did not reopen them. After a moment, he began to snore. "He tires easily," Martell said quietly. He turned to Sophronia, although still keeping a wary eye on Sparhawk. "Little mother," he greeted her in a tone between irony and regret. "Martell?" She inclined her head in the briefest of nods. "Ah," he said, "it seems that I've disappointed you."
"Not so much as you've disappointed yourself, I think."
"Punishment, Sophronia?" he asked sardonically. "Don't you think I've been punished enough already?"
"It's not in my nature to punish people, Martell. Nature gives neither rewards nor punishment, only consequences."
"All right, then. I accept the consequences. Will you at least permit me to greet you, and to seek your blessing?" He took her wrists and turned her palms up.
"No, Martell," she replied, closing her hands. "I don't think so. You're no longer my pupil. You've found another to follow."
"That wasn't entirely my idea, Sophronia. You rejected me, you remember." He sighed and released her wrists. Then he looked back at Sparhawk. "I'm really rather surprised to see you, brother mine," he said, "considering all the times I've sent Addis to deal with you. I'll have to speak sharply with him about that, provided you haven't killed him, of course." "He was bleeding a little the last time I saw him," Sparhawk said, "but not very seriously." "Addis doesn't pay much attention to blood, not even his own." "Would you like to step out of the way, Sophronia?"
Sparhawk said, opening the front of his robe and shifting his sword hilt around slightly. Martell and I were having a little discussion the last time we saw each other. I think it's time we continued it. Martell's eyes narrowed and he opened his own robe. Like Sparhawk, he also wore mail and a broadsword.
Excellent notion, Sparhawk, he said, his deep voice dropping to little more than a whisper.
Sophronia stepped between them.
Stop that, both of you, she commanded. This isn't the time or the place. We are right in the middle of an army. If you play this game of yours here in Arasham's tent, you'll have half of Rendor in here with you before it's over.
Sparhawk felt a hot surge of disappointment, but he knew that she was right. Regretfully, he took his hand away from his sword hilt.
Sometime soon, however, Martell, he said in a dreadfully quiet voice.
I'll be happy to oblige you, dear brother, Martell replied with an ironic bow. His eyes narrowed speculatively. What are you two doing here in Rendor? He asked. I thought you were still in Camoria.
It's a business trip.
Ah, you found out about the Darrastim, I see. I hate to tell you this, but you're wasting your time. There's no antidote. I checked that very carefully before I recommended it to a certain friend in Simera.
You're pressing your luck, Martell, Sparhawk told him ominously.
I always have, brother mine. As they say, no risk, no profit. Elana will die, I'm afraid. Lycaeus will succeed her, and Annius will become archprelate. I expect to reap quite a handsome profit from that.
Is that all you ever think about?
What else is there? Martell shrugged. Everything else is only an illusion. How's Vanion been lately?
He's well, Sparhawk replied. I'll tell him you asked.
That's assuming that you live long enough to see him again. Your situation here is precarious, my old friend.
So is yours, Martell.
I know, but I'm used to it. You're weighted down with scruples and the like. I left all that behind a long time ago.
Where's your tame Damok, Martell? Sophronia asked suddenly.
He looked only slightly surprised, and he recovered instantly.
I really haven't the slightest idea, little mother, he replied. It comes to me without being summoned, so I never know when it's going to turn up.
Perhaps it returned to the place it came from. It has to do that every so often, you know.
I've never been that curious about the creatures of the underworld.
That could be a serious oversight.
Perhaps.
Arasham stirred on his cushions and opened his eyes.
Did I doze off?
He asked.
Only briefly, most holy, Martell said. It gave Sparhawk and me time to renew our friendship. We had much to discuss.
Very much, Sparhawk agreed. He hesitated slightly, but then decided that Martell was so sure of himself that he'd probably missed the significance of the question.
You mentioned a talisman during your sermon, Holy One, he said to Arasham. Might we be permitted to see it?
The holy relic? Of course.
The old man fumbled inside his robe and drew out something that appeared to be a twisted lump of bone. He held it out proudly.
Do you know what this is, Sparhawk?
He asked. No, most holy, I'm afraid not.
The blessed Ishand began life as a shepherd, you know.
Yes, I'd heard so.
One day when he was quite young, a ewe in his flock gave birth to a pure white lamb that was like none other he had ever seen. Unlike all other sheep of that breed, this infant ram bore horns upon its head. It was, of course, a sign from God. The pure lamb obviously symbolized the blessed Ishand himself, and the fact that the lamb was horned could only mean one thing, that Ishand had been chosen to chastise the church for her iniquity.
How mysterious are the ways of God, Sparhawk marveled.
Truly, my son. Truly. Ishand cared for the ram most tenderly, and in time it began to speak to him, and its voice was the voice of God himself, and thus God instructed Ishand in that which he must do. This holy relic is a piece of the horn of that very ram. Now you can see why it has such enormous power.
Clearly, most holy, Sparhawk said in a reverent tone of voice.
Come closer, little sister, he said to Sophrenia. View this miraculous relic. She stepped forward and looked intently at the twisted bit of horn in Arasham's hand.
Remarkable, she murmured.
She glanced at Sparhawk, shaking her head almost imperceptibly. The bitter taste of disappointment filled his mouth.
The power of this talisman will overcome all the concerted might of the accursed church knights and their foul witchcraft, Arasham declared. God himself has told me so.
He smiled almost shyly.
I have discovered a truly remarkable thing, he told them confidentially. When I am alone, I can lift the holy relic to my ear and hear the voice of God. Thus he instructs me, even as he instructed the blessed Ashand.
A miracle, Martell said in mock amazement.
Is it not?
Arasham beamed. We are quite overcome with gratitude that you have consented to let us view the talisman, most holy, Sparhawk said. And we will spread word of it throughout the kingdoms of the north, won't we, Martell? Oh, of course, of course. Martell's face was slightly puzzled, and he was looking suspiciously at Sparhawk. I perceive now that our coming here is a part of God's design, Sparhawk continued. It is our mission to tell all the kingdoms of the north of this miracle, through every village and at every crossroads. Even now I feel the Spirit of God infusing my tongue with eloquence so that I might better describe what I have seen. He reached out and clapped Martell on the left shoulder, quite firmly. Don't you feel it as well, dear brother? He asked enthusiastically. Martell winced slightly, and Sparhawk could feel the shoulder shrinking from under his hand. Why, yes, Martell admitted in a slightly pained voice. As a matter of fact, I believe I do.
Wondrous is the might of God,
Arasham exulted. Yes, Martell said, rubbing at his shoulder. Wondrous. The idea had been slow in coming, in part, perhaps, because of the surprise of once again seeing Martell. But now it all began to fall into place. Sparhawk was suddenly glad that Martell was here. And now, most holy, he said, let me give you the remainder of His Majesty's message to you.
Of course, my ears are open to you.
His Majesty commands me to implore you to give him time to marshal his forces before you move against the venal church here in Rendor. He must move with caution in his mobilization because the hierocracy in Kyrelos has spies everywhere. He wishes devoutly to aid you, but the church is powerful, and he must mass sufficient force to overcome her might in Deira at one stroke, lest she recover and crush him. It is his thought that should you mount your campaign here in the south at the same time he mounts his in the north, the church will be confounded, not knowing which way to turn, and by moving swiftly you may take advantage of her confusion and win victory after victory. The impact of these victories will dishearten and demoralize the forces of the church, and you may both march triumphant upon Kyrelos.
Praise God!
Arasham exclaimed, starting to his feet and brandishing his sheep's horn like a weapon. Sparhawk raised one hand. But, he cautioned, this grand design, which can only have come from God himself, has no chance of success unless you and His Majesty attack simultaneously.
I can see that, of course. God's own voice has instructed me in just such strategy.
I was sure that he had. Sparhawk let his face assume an expression of extreme cunning. Now, he went on, the church is as sly as a serpent, and she has ears everywhere. Despite our best efforts to maintain secrecy, she may uncover our plan. Her first recourse has always been deceit.
I have seen that in her, Arasham admitted.
It may well be that once she has uncovered our plan, she will attempt deception. And what better way to deceive you than to send false messengers to you to declare that His Majesty is in readiness, when indeed he is not? Thus the church could defeat you and your disciples one by one. Arasham frowned.
That's true, isn't it? He said. But how may we avoid being deceived?
Sparhawk pretended to think about it. Then he suddenly snapped his fingers. I have it, he exclaimed. What better way to confound the deceitfulness of the church than by the word, a word known only to you and to me and to King Obler of Deira? Thus may you know that a message is genuine. Should any come to you with the message that the time has come, but who cannot repeat the word to you, that man will be most surely a serpent of the church sent to deceive you, and you should deal with him accordingly. Arashim thought about it.
Why, yes,
he mumbled finally.
I believe that might indeed confound the church. But what word can be so locked in our hearts that none may seek it out?
Sparhawk threw a covert glance at Martell, whose face was suddenly filled with chagrin. It must be a word of power, he said, squinting at the roof of the tent as if deep in thought. The whole ploy was obvious, even childish, but it was the kind of thing that would appeal to the senile old Arashim, and it provided a marvelous opportunity to settle a few scores with Martell just for old time's sake. Sophrania sighed and lifted her eyes in resignation. Sparhawk felt a little ashamed of himself at that point. He looked at Arashim, who was leaning forward in anticipation, chewing upon emptiness with his toothless mouth and setting his long beard to waggling. I will, of course, accept your pledge of secrecy without question, most holy, Sparhawk said in feigned humility. I, however, swear by my life that the word I am about to give you in profoundest secrecy shall never again pass my lips until I divulge it to King Obler in Asye, the capital of his kingdom.
And I also pledge my oath to you, noble friend Sparhawk,
the old man cried in an excess of enthusiasm.
Torture will not drag the word from my lips.
He made some attempt to draw himself up regally. Your pledge honors me most holy, Sparhawk replied with a deep renderish bow. He approached the old man, bent, and whispered, Ram's horn. Arashim, he noted, didn't smell very good.
The perfect word,
Arashim cried. He seized Sparhawk's head in a pair of wiry arms and kissed him soundly, full on the mouth. Martell, his face pale with anger, had tried to draw near enough to hear, but Sophrania stepped in front of him. His eyes flashed angrily, and with obvious effort he restrained his first impulse to thrust her out of his way. She raised her chin and looked him full in the face.
Well, she said.
He muttered something, turned, and stalked to the far side of the tent, where he stood gnawing at a knuckle in frustration. Arashim still clung to Sparhawk's neck.
My beloved son and deliverer,
he cried with his rheumy eyes filled with tears.
Surely you have been sent to me by God himself. We cannot fail now. God is on our side. Let the wicked tremble before us.
Truly, Sparhawk agreed, gently disengaging the old man's arms from about his neck. A thought, holy one, Martell said shrewdly, though his face was still white with fury. Sparhawk is only human and therefore mortal. The world is full of mischance. Might it not be wiser to...
Mischance? Sparhawk cut him off quickly. Where is your faith, Martell? This is God's design, not mine. God will not permit me to die until I have performed this service for him.
Have faith, dear brother. God will sustain and keep me against all perils. It is my destiny to fulfill this task, and God will see to it that I do not fail.
Praise God!
Arashim exclaimed ecstatically, ending the discussion. The doe-eyed boy brought in the melons at that point, and the conversation shifted to more general matters. Arashim delivered another rambling diatribe against the church while Martell sat scowling at Sparhawk. Sparhawk kept his eyes on his melon, which was surprisingly good. It had all been too easy somehow, and that worried him just a little. Martell was too clever, too devious to have been so easily circumvented. He looked appraisingly across the tent at the white-haired man he had hated for so long. Martell's expression was baffled, frustrated. And that was also not like him. The Martell he had known as a youth would never have revealed such emotions. Sparhawk began to feel a little less sure of himself. A thought has just occurred to me, most holy, he said. Time is crucial in this affair, and it is essential that my sister and I return to Deira at once to advise His Majesty that all here in Rendor is ready, and to convey to his ears alone that word which is locked in both our hearts. We have good horses, of course, but a fast boat could take us downriver and deliver us to the seaport at Jirok days earlier. Perhaps you or one of your disciples might know of some dependable boat owner here in Dabur whom I could hire. Arashim blinked at him vaguely.
A boat?
He mumbled. A faint movement caught Sparhawk's eye, and he saw Sophronia move her arm as if only shaking back her sleeve. Instantly he knew what she had been doing all along.
"Hire, my son?"
Arasham beamed at him.
"Let there be no talk of hiring. I have a splendid boat at my disposal. You will take it, and with my blessing. I will send armed men with you, and a regiment, no, a legion, to patrol the banks of the river to make sure you reach Jurok safely."
"It shall be as you command, most holy," Sparhawk said. He looked across the tent at Martell with a beatific smile. "Is it not amazing, dear brother?" he said. "Truly such wisdom and generosity can only come from God." "Yes," Martell replied darkly, "I'm sure of it." "I must make haste, holy Arasham," Sparhawk rushed on, rising to his feet. "We left our horses and belongings in the care of a servant in a house on the outskirts of town. My sister and I will retrieve them at once and return within the hour."
"As you see fit, my son," Arasham said eagerly, "and I will instruct my disciples to have the boat and the soldiers made ready for your journey downriver."
"Let me show you the way out of the compound, dear brother," Martell said from between clenched teeth. "Gladly, dear brother," Sparhawk said. "Your company, as always, fills my heart with joy."
"Return directly, Martell," Arasham instructed. "We must discuss this wondrous turn of fortune, and offer thanks to God for his grace in providing it."
"Yes, most holy," Martell said, bowing. "I shall come back immediately."
"Within the hour, Sparhawk,"
Arasham said. "Within the hour, most holy," Sparhawk agreed with a deep bow. "Come along then, Martell," he said, once again smacking his hand down on the renegade's shoulder. "Of course." Martell winced, once again shrinking from Sparhawk's comradely blow. Once they were outside the pavilion, Martell turned on Sparhawk, his face white with fury. "Just what do you think you're doing?" he demanded. "Testy today, aren't we, old boy?" Sparhawk said mildly. "What are you up to, Sparhawk?" Martell snarled, looking around to be sure that no one in the crowd of hovering disciples could hear him. "I just spiked your wheel, Martell," Sparhawk replied. "Arasham will sit here until he petrifies unless someone brings him that secret word. I can almost guarantee you that the church knights will be in Kyrillos when the time comes to elect the new archprelate, because there won't be anything going on in Rendor to drag them away." "Very clever, Sparhawk. I'm glad you liked it." "This is one more debt you owe me," Martell grated. "Feel free to call them in at any time, dear brother," Sparhawk said. "I'll be more than happy to accommodate you." He took Sophronia by the elbow and led her away.
"Are you completely out of your senses, Sparhawk?" she demanded once they were out of earshot of the fuming Martell.
"I don't think so," he replied. "Of course, crazy people never really know, do they?"
"What were you doing in there? Do you realize how many times I had to step in to keep you out of trouble?"
"I noticed that. I couldn't have pulled it off without you."
"Will you stop smirking and tell me what was behind all that?"
"Martell was getting too close to our real reason for being here," he explained. "I had to throw something else in his path to keep him from realizing that we'd unearthed the possible antidote for the poison. It all worked out rather well, even if I do say so myself."
"If you knew you were going to do that before you went into the tent, why didn't you tell me?"
"How could I have known, Sophronia? I didn't even know Martell was there until I saw him."
"You mean..."
Her eyes went suddenly very wide. He nodded. "I sort of made it up as I went along," he confessed.
"Oh, Sparhawk," she said disgustedly. "You know better than that."
He shrugged. "It was about the best I could do on short notice."
"Why did you keep hitting Martell on the shoulder like that?"
"He broke that shoulder when he was about 15. It's always been very sensitive."
"That was cruel," she accused.
"So was what happened in that alley back in Cypria 10 years ago. Let's go get Curic and Flute. I think we've done about all we can here in Dabur." Arasham's boat was more like a barge than the scow which had carried them upriver, and it was perhaps 4 times as large. Banks of oarsmen lined each side, and black-robed zealots with swords and javelins clustered in the torchlit bow and stern. Martell had preceded them to the rickety dock, and he stood alone there, some distance from the hot-eyed disciples on shore, as Sparhawk, Sophronia, Curic, and Flute embarked. The renegade's white hair gleamed in the starlight, and his face was very nearly as pale. "You're not going to get away with this, Sparhawk," he said in a low voice.
"Oh?" Sparhawk said. "I think you'd better look again, Martell. It seems to me that I already did. You can try to follow me, of course, but all those troops patrolling the riverbanks are probably going to get in your way. Besides, I think that once you get over your peak, you'll realize that about the only thing you can do is stay here and try to wheedle that magic word out of Arashim. Everything you've set up here in Rendor will be at a standstill until you do."
"You'll pay for this, Sparhawk," Martell promised darkly. "I thought I already had, old boy," Sparhawk replied. "In Cypria, I believe it was." He reached out and Martell jerked his shoulder out of range. Instead, however, Sparhawk patted him on the cheek insultingly. "Take care of yourself, Martell," he said. "I want to see you again, soon, and I want you to be well and in full possession of your faculties. Believe me, you're going to need them." Then he turned and went up the gangway to the waiting barge. The sailors cast off all lines and pushed the barge out into the slowly moving current. Then they ran out their oars and began to row slowly downriver. The dock behind them and the solitary man standing on the end of it shrank out of sight.
"Oh, God!" Sparhawk cried exultantly. "I loved that!"
The run down river took them a day and a half, and they disembarked a league or so upstream from Jirok to avoid any watchers Martell might have managed to get to the docks ahead of them. The precaution was probably unnecessary, Sparhawk admitted, but there was no point in taking chances. They entered the city through the west gate, and mingled with the crowds as they made their way to Vorin's house again. It was late afternoon when they entered. Vorin was a trifle surprised at their reappearance.
"That was quick," he said as they entered his garden.
"We were lucky," Sparhawk shrugged.
"More than lucky," Sophronia said darkly. The small woman's temper had not noticeably improved since they had left Dabur, and she still refused even to talk to Sparhawk.
"Did something go wrong?" Vorin asked mildly.
"Not that I noticed," Sparhawk replied blithely.
"Stop congratulating yourself, Sparhawk," she snapped. "I'm vexed with you, very vexed."
"I'm sorry about that, Sophronia, but I did the best I could."
He turned to Vorin.
"We ran into Martell," he explained, "and I managed to stop him in his tracks. His whole scheme just collapsed around his ears."
Vorin whistled.
"I don't see anything wrong with that, Sophronia."
"It's not what he did, Vorin. It was the way he did it."
"Oh?
I don't want to talk about it." She gathered Flute up in her arms, went to the bench by the fountain, and sat muttering darkly to the little girl in Styrek.
"We need a way to get aboard a fast ship bound for Vardanias without being seen," Sparhawk told Vorin. "Can you come up with something?"
"Quite easily," Vorin replied. "Every so often the true identity of one of our brothers is exposed. We've devised a way to get them out of Rendor safely." He smiled ironically. "It was the first thing I did when I got to Jirok, actually. I was fairly sure I was going to need it for myself almost immediately. I have a wharf down in the harbor. There's a waterfront inn not far away. It's run by one of our brothers, and it has all the things an inn usually has. Tap rooms, stables, sleeping rooms upstairs, and the like. It's also got a cellar. There's a passageway running from that one to the cellar of my main warehouse. At low tide, you can board a ship directly from that cellar without being seen by anyone on shore."
"Would that fool the Damark, Sophronia?" Sparhawk asked her.
She glared at him for a moment, then relented. She touched the fingertips of one hand lightly to her temple. Sparhawk noted that there was more silver there now.
"I think it would," she replied. "We don't even know that the Damark is here. Martell could actually have been telling us the truth."
"I wouldn't count on it," Curic grunted.
"Even so," she continued, "the Damork probably couldn't begin to grasp the concept of a cellar, much less underground passageways."
"What's a Damork?" Vorin asked.
Sparhawk told him, and described what had happened to Captain Mabin's ship in the Arshan Straits just out from Madel.
Vorin rose and began to pace up and down. "That's not the sort of thing our escape route was designed to cope with," he admitted. "I think I'd better take some additional precautions.
I've got 6 ships in port just now. Why don't I just send them all out at the same time? If you sail out in the middle of a flotilla, it might add a bit more confusion.
Isn't that a bit elaborate? Sparhawk asked him.
Sparhawk, I know how modest you are, but you're probably the most important man in the world just now. At least you are until you get to Simara and make your report to Vanyon. I'm not going to take any chances with you if I can help it. He went to the garden wall and squinted at the setting sun. We're going to have to hurry, he told them. Low tide this evening comes just after dusk, and I'll want you in the cellar when the ship's rail drops below the edge of the wharf. I'll go with you to make sure you get on board safely. They all rowed out together toward the waterfront. Their route took them through the familiar quarter where Sparhawk had maintained his shop during the years he had been hidden here. The buildings on either side of the streets were almost like old friends, and he thought he recognized a few of the people hurrying home through the narrow streets as the sun sank toward the western horizon.
Brute!
The voice from behind them probably carried halfway across the Arshan Straits, and it was painfully familiar.
Assassin!
Oh, no, Sparhawk groaned, reining Farron in. And we were so close. He looked longingly at the waterfront inn to which Voren was leading them, and which was but one street away.
Monster!
The voice went on in a strident tone. Sparhawk, Kurek said mildly. Is it my imagination, or is that lady trying to get your attention?
Just let it lie, Kurek.
Anything you say, my lord.
Assassin! Brute! Monster! Deserter!
There was a brief pause.
Murderer!
The woman added. I never did that, Sparhawk murmured. He sighed and turned Farron around. Hello, Lelius, he said to the robed and veiled woman who had been shouting at him. He spoke in as mild and inoffensive a tone as he could manage.
Hello, Lelius, she shrieked. Hello, Lelius. Is that all you have to say for yourself, brigand?
Sparhawk tried very hard not to smile. In a peculiar way, he loved Lelius, and he was pleased to see her enjoying herself so much. You're looking well, Lelius, he said conversationally, knowing that a comment like that would spur her to new heights.
Well? Well? When you have murdered me? When you have cut my heart out? When you have sunk me in the mire of deepest despair?
She leaned back in a tragic posture, head up and arms thrown wide. Hardly a morsel of food has passed my lips since that hateful day when you abandoned me penniless in the gutter.
I left you the shop, Lelius, he protested. It fed us both before I left. Surely it still feeds you. Shop? What do I care about the shop? It is my heart that you have broken, Makra.
She thrust back her hood and ripped off her veil.
Assassin, she cried. Look at your handiwork.
She began to tear at her long, glossy black hair and to gouge at her dark, full-lipped face with her fingernails.
Lelius,
Sparhawk barked in the tone he had only had to use a few times during their years together.
Stop that. You'll hurt yourself.
But Lelius was in full voice now, and there was no stopping her.
Hurt? She cried tragically. What do I care about hurt? How can you hurt a dead woman? You want to see hurt, Makra? Look at my heart.
She ripped open the front of her robe. It was not her heart, however, that she revealed. Oh, my goodness, Kurek said in an awed voice, staring at the woman's suddenly revealed attributes. Voren turned his head aside, concealing a smile. Sophrenia, however, looked at Sparhawk with a slightly different expression.
Oh, God, Sparhawk groaned.
He swung down from his saddle.
Lelius, he muttered sharply to her. Cover yourself. Think of the neighbors and all the children watching. What do I care about the neighbors? Let them look.
She thrust out her full breasts.
What does shame mean to a woman whose heart is dead?
Grimly, Sparhawk advanced on her. When he got close enough, he spoke quietly to her from between clenched teeth. They're very nice, Lelius, he said, but I don't really think they're much of a surprise to any man within 6 streets in any direction. Do you really want to go on with this? She suddenly looked a little less certain, but she did not close the front of her robe.
Have it your way, he shrugged. Then he too raised his voice. Your heart is not dead, Lelius, he declared to the audience breathlessly clustered on the second floor balconies. Far from it, I think. What of Georgius, the baker? And Nendan, the sausage maker? He was selecting names at random. Her face blanched, and she shrank back, covering her generous bosom with her robe. "You know?" she faltered. That hurt him just a little, but he covered it. "Of course," he declared, still playing to the balconies. "But I forgive you. You are much woman, Lilius, and not meant to be alone." He reached out and gently covered her hair with her hood again. "Have you been well?" he asked her very softly. "I get by," she whispered. "Good. Are we almost done?" "I think we need something to round it out, don't you?" Her face looked hopeful. He tried very hard to keep from laughing. "This is serious, Makra," she hissed. "My position in the community depends on it." "Trust me," he murmured. "You have betrayed me, Lilius," he said to the balconies, "but I forgive you, for I have not been here to keep you from straying." She considered that for a moment, then sobbed, fell into his arms, and buried her face in his chest. "It's just that I missed you so much, my Makra. I weakened. I am but a poor, ignorant woman, a slave to my passions. Can you ever truly forgive me?" "What is there to forgive, my Lilius?" he said grandly. "You are like the earth, like the sea. To give is a part of your nature." She thrust herself back from him. "Beat me," she demanded. "I deserve to be beaten." Huge tears, genuine for all he knew, stood in her glowing black eyes. "Oh, no," he refused, knowing exactly where that would lead. "No beatings, Lilius," he said. "Only this." And he gave her a single chaste kiss, full on the lips. "Be well, Lilius," he murmured softly. Then he stepped back quickly before she could wrap her arms about his neck. He knew just how strong her arms were. "And now, though it rends my soul, I must leave you again," he declaimed. He reached out and drew her veil once again across her face. "Think of me from time to time, whilst I seek out the fate that destiny has in store for me." He did manage to resist the impulse to lay his hand on his heart. "I knew it," she cried, more to the onlookers than to him. "I knew that you were a man of affairs. I shall carry our love in my heart for all eternity, my Makra, and I shall remain faithful to you to the grave. And if you live, come back to me." She had both arms spread wide again. "And if you do not, send your ghost to me in my dreams, and I will comfort your pale shade as best I can." He backed away from her outstretched arms. Then he spun so that his robe would swirl dramatically, he owed her that much, and vaulted into Theron's saddle. "Farewell, my Lilius," he said melodramatically, jerking the reins to make Theron rear and paw the air with his front hooves. "And if we do not meet again in this world, may God grant that we meet once more in the next." And he drove his heels into Theron's flanks and charged past her at a gallop. "Did you do all that on purpose?" Sophrenia asked as they dismounted in the courtyard of the waterfront inn. "I might have gotten a little carried away," Sparhawk admitted. "Lilius does that to a man from time to time." He smiled a bit ruefully. "She gets her heart broken on an average of 3 times a week, he noted clinically. "She was always militantly unfaithful and just a little dishonest where the cash box was concerned. She's vain and vulgar and self-indulgent. She's deceptive and greedy and grossly overdramatic." He paused then, thinking back over the years. "I liked her, though. She's a good girl despite her faults, and living with her was never dull. I owed her that performance. She'll be able to walk through the quarter like a queen now, and it didn't really cost me all that much, did it?" "Sparhawk," she said gravely, "I will never understand you." "That's what makes it all so much fun, isn't it, little mother?" He grinned at her. Flute, still sitting on Sophrenia's white horse, blew a mocking little trill on her pipes. "Talk with her," Sparhawk suggested to Sophrenia. "She understands." Flute rolled her eyes at him, then generously held out her hands to permit him to help her down. Chapter 24. The voyage across the mouth of the Arshan Strait passed without incident. They ran northeasterly under clear skies, with a fair following breeze, and with the other ships of Vorin's flotilla clustered about them protectively. About noon on the third day out, Sparhawk came up on deck to join Sophrenia in the bow, where she and Flute stood looking out over the sparkling waves. "Are you still cross with me?" he asked her. She sighed. "No, I suppose not." Sparhawk was not entirely certain how to put his vague sense of unease into words, so he approached it obliquely. Sophrenia,
he said. Did it seem to you that everything in Dabur went just a little too smoothly? I somehow get the feeling that I'm being led around by the nose again.
How do you mean exactly?
I know you tampered with Arasham a few times that night, but did you do anything to Martell?
No. He'd have felt it if I'd tried, and he'd have countered me.
That's what I thought. What was wrong with him, then?
I'm not sure I follow you.
He acted almost like a schoolboy. We both know Martell. He's intelligent, and he thinks very fast on his feet. What I did was so obvious that he should have seen through it almost immediately, but he didn't do a thing. He just stood there like an idiot and let me pull his whole scheme down around his ears. It was just too easy, and that worries me.
He didn't really expect to see us in Arasham's tent, Sparhawk. Maybe the surprise threw him off balance.
Martell doesn't surprise all that easily.
She frowned. No, she admitted. He doesn't, does he?
She thought about it.
Do you remember what Lord Darrellon was saying before we left Simera?
Not exactly, no.
He said that Annius behaved like a simpleton when he presented his case to the Aline Kings. He announced the death of Count Radon without even verifying the fact that the Count had really died.
Oh, yes. Now I remember. And you said that the whole scheme, the attempt to murder the Count and to lay the blame on the Pandions, might have originated with a Styric magician.
Perhaps it goes a little farther than that.
We know that Martell has had contacts with the Domork, and that means that Azash is involved somehow.
Azash has always dealt with Styrics, so he's had very little experience with the subtleties of the Aline mind. The gods of Styricum are very direct, and they seldom prepare for contingencies, probably because of the Styric lack of sophistication. Now, the whole purpose of the plot in Arsham, and the one in Rendor, has been to keep the Church Knights out of Kyrelos during the election. Annius behaved the way a Styric would have in the palace at Simera, and Martell behaved the same way in Arasham's tent.
You're a little inconsistent, Sophrenia, he objected. First you try to tell me that Styrics are unsophisticated, then you come up with an explanation so complicated that I can't even follow it. Why don't you just say what you mean?
Azash has always dominated the minds of his followers, she replied, and for the most part they've been Styrics. If Annius and Martell both start behaving like Styrics, it raises some very interesting possibilities, wouldn't you say?
I'm sorry, Sophrenia, but I can't accept that. Whatever other faults he may have, Martell's still an Aline, and Annius is a churchman. Neither one of them would give his soul to Azash.
Not consciously, perhaps, but Azash has ways to subvert the minds of people he finds useful.
Where does all this lead?
I'm not entirely sure, but it seems that Azash has some reason to want Annius to be the new archprelate. It's something we might want to keep in mind. If Azash is controlling Annius and Martell, they're both going to be thinking like Styrics, and Styrics don't react very fast when they're surprised. It's a racial trait. Surprise could be our best weapon.
Was that why you were so angry with me? Because I surprised you?
Of course. I thought you knew that.
Next time I'll try to warn you.
I'd appreciate that.
2 days later, their ship entered the estuary of the River Usera and sailed up toward the Alanian port city of Vardanias. As they approached the wharves, however, Sparhawk saw trouble. Men in red tunics were patrolling the waterfront. "Now what?" Kurik asked, as the two of them crouched behind a low deckhouse to keep out of sight. Sparhawk frowned. "I suppose we could sail across the bay and go inland on the Arshan side." "If they're watching the seaports, they're bound to be patrolling the border as well. Use your head, Sparhawk."
"Maybe we could slip across at night."
"Isn't what we're doing a little too important to hang it all on a maybe?" Kurik asked pointedly. Sparhawk started to swear. "We've got to get to Simera," he said. "It's getting close to the time when another of the 12 knights is going to die, and I don't know how much more of the weight Sophrenia can carry. Think, Kurik, you're always better at tactics than I am." "That's because I don't wear armor. The sense of invincibility does funny things to a man's brains." "Thanks," Sparhawk said dryly. Kurik knit his brows in thought. "Well," Sparhawk said impatiently, "I'm working on it. Don't rush me." "We're getting closer to that wharf, Kurik."
"I can see that. Can you tell if they're searching any of the ships?" Sparhawk raised his head and peered over the top of the deckhouse. They don't seem to be. Good. That means we won't have to make any spur-of-the-moment decisions. We can go below and work this out. Any ideas at all? You're pushing, Sparhawk, Jurek said disapprovingly. That's one of your failings, you know. You always want to dash into the middle of things before you've thought your way completely through what you're going to do. Their ship hove to beside a tar-smeared wharf, and the sailors cast lines to the longshoremen clustered there. Then they ran out the gangway and began to carry boxes and bales down to the wharf. There was a clattering sound from the hold, and Theron trotted up on deck. Sparhawk stared at his warhorse in amazement. Flute sat cross-legged on the big roan's broad back, playing her pipes. The melody she played was a peculiarly drowsy one, almost like a lullaby. Before Sparhawk and Kira could run to intercept her, she tapped Farron's back with the side of her foot, and he placidly walked down the gangway to the wharf. "What is she doing?" Kira exclaimed. "I can't even begin to guess. Go get Sophrenia. Fast!" On the wharf, Flute rode directly toward the squad of church soldiers stationed at the far end. The soldiers had been closely examining every disembarking passenger and sailor, but they paid no attention to Flute and the roan horse. She impudently rode back and forth in front of them several times, then turned. She seemed to be looking directly at Sparhawk, and still playing her pipes, she raised one little hand and motioned to him. He stared at her. She made a little face and then quite deliberately rode directly through the soldiers' ranks. They absently stepped aside for her, but not one of them so much as looked at her. "What's going on down there?" he demanded as Sophrenia and Curic joined him behind the deckhouse. "I'm not altogether sure," Sophrenia replied, frowning. "Why aren't the soldiers paying any attention to her?" Curic asked as Flute rode through the ranks of red tunics once again. "I don't think they can see her." "But she's right there in front of them." "That doesn't seem to matter." Her face slowly took on an expression of wonder. "I'd heard about this," she murmured. "I thought it was just an old folk tale, but perhaps I was wrong." She turned to Sparhawk. "Has she looked back at the ship at all since she rode down onto that wharf?" "She sort of motioned to me to follow her," he said. "You're sure?" "That's the way it looked to me." She drew in a deep breath. "Well," she said, "there's one way to find out, I suppose." Before Sparhawk could stop her, she rose and walked out from behind the deckhouse. "Sophrenia!" he called after her, but she continued on across the deck as if she had not heard him. She reached the rail and stood there. "She's right out in plain sight," Curic said in a strangled tone. "I can see that. The soldiers are certain to have a description of her. Has she gone out of her mind?" "I doubt it. Look." Sparhawk pointed toward the soldiers on the wharf. Although Sophrenia was standing in plain view, they did not even appear to look at her. Flute, however, saw her, and made another of those imperious little gestures. Sophrenia sighed and looked at Sparhawk. "Wait here," she said. "Wait where?" "Here, on board ship." She turned, walked to the gangway, and went on down to the wharf. "That rips it," Sparhawk said bleakly, rising to his feet and drawing his sword. Quickly he counted the soldiers on the wharf. "There aren't that many of them," he said to Curic. "If we can take them by surprise, there might be a chance." "Not a very good one, Sparhawk. Let's wait a moment and see what happens." Sophrenia walked up the wharf and stopped directly in front of the soldiers. They ignored her. She spoke to them. They paid no attention. Then she turned back toward the ship. "It's all right, Sparhawk," she called. "They can't see us or hear us. Bring the other horses and our things." "Magic?" Curic asked in a stunned voice. "Not any kind that I ever heard about," Sparhawk replied. "I guess we'd better do what she says then," Curic advised, "and sort of immediately. I'd hate to be right in the middle of those soldiers when the spell wears off." It was eerie to walk down the gangway in plain view of the church soldiers and to saunter casually up the wharf until they were face to face with them. The soldiers' expressions were bored, and they gave no indication that anything at all was amiss. They routinely stopped every sailor and passenger leaving the wharf, but paid no attention whatsoever to Sparhawk, Curic, and the horses. The soldiers stepped out of the way with no command from their corporal, and immediately closed ranks again once Sparhawk and Curic had led the horses off the wharf and onto the cobblestones of the street. Without a word, Sparhawk lifted Flute down from Farron's back and saddled the big roan. All right, he said to Sophronia when he had finished. How did she do it?
The usual way.
But she can't talk, or at least she doesn't. How did she cast the spell?
With her pipes, Sparhawk. I thought you knew that. She doesn't speak the spell, she plays it on her pipes.
Is that possible? His tone was incredulous.
You just saw her do it.
Could you do it that way? She shook her head.
I'm just a bit tone-deaf, Sparhawk, she confessed. I can't really tell one note from another except in a general sort of way, and the melody has to be very precise.
Shall we go, then? They rode up through the streets of Vardanias from the harbor. Are we still invisible? Keurig asked.
We're not actually invisible, Keurig, Sophronia replied, wrapping her cloak about Flute, who still played the drowsy tune on her pipes. If we were, we wouldn't be able to see each other.
I don't understand at all.
The soldiers knew we were there, Keurig. They stepped out of the way for us, remember? They just chose not to pay any attention to us.
Chose?
Perhaps that was the wrong word. Let's say they were encouraged not to.
They rode out through the north gate of Vardanias without being stopped by the guards posted there, and were soon on the high road to Simera. The weather had changed since they had left Alania many weeks before. The chill of winter had gone now, and the first budding leaves of spring tipped the branches of the trees at the sides of the road. Peasants plodded across their fields behind their plows, turning over the rich black loam. The rains had passed, and the sky was bright blue, dotted here and there with puffy white clouds.
The breeze was fresh and warm, and the earth smelled of growth and renewal. They had discarded their renderish robes before leaving the ship, but Sparhawk still found his mail coat and padded tunic uncomfortably warm. Keurig was looking out at the freshly plowed fields they passed with an appraising eye.
I hope the boys have finished with the plowing at home, he said. I'd hate to have that chore in front of me when I get back.
Asladi will see to it that they get it done, Sparhawk assured him.
You're probably right. Keurig made a wry face. When you get right down to it, she's a better farmer than I am.
Women always are, Sophronia told him. They're more in tune with the moon and the seasons. In Styricum, women always manage the fields.
What do the men do?
As little as possible.
It took them nearly 5 days to reach Simera, and they arrived on an early spring afternoon. Sparhawk reined in atop a hill a mile or so west of town.
Can she do it again? He asked Sophronia.
Can who do what again?
Flute. Can she make people ignore us again?
I don't know. Why don't you ask her?
Why don't you ask her?
I don't think she likes me.
Whatever gave you that idea?
She adores you.
Sophronia leaned forward slightly and spoke in Styric to the little girl who rested against her.
Flute nodded and made an obscure kind of circling gesture with one hand.
What did she say? Sparhawk asked.
Approximately, that the chapter house is on the other side of Simera. She suggests that we circle the city rather than ride through the streets.
Approximately?
It loses a great deal in translation.
All right, we'll do it her way then. I definitely don't want Annius to find out that we're back in Simera.
They rode on around the city, passing through open fields and sparse woodlands, and keeping about a mile back from the city wall. Simera was not an attractive city, Sparhawk decided. The peculiar combination of its location and the prevailing weather seemed to capture the smoke from its thousands of chimneys and to hold it in a continual pall just above the rooftops. That lowering cloud of smoke made the place look perpetually grimy. They finally reached a thicket about a half mile from the walls of the chapter house. Once again the land was dotted with peasants at work, and the road leading out from the east gate was alive with brightly dressed travelers.
Tell her it's time, Sparhawk said to Sophronia. I'd imagine that a fair number of those people out there are working for Annius.
She knows, Sparhawk, she's not stupid.
No, only a little flighty.
Flute made a face at him and began to play her pipes. It was that same lethargic, almost drowsy tune she had played in Vardanias. They started across the field toward the few houses clustered outside the chapter house. Though he was certain that the people they passed would pay no attention to them, Sparhawk instinctively tensed at each encounter.
Relax, Sparhawk, Sophronia ordered him crisply. You're making it harder for her.
Sorry, he mumbled.
Habit, I guess. With some effort, he pulled a kind of calm about himself. A number of workmen were repairing the road that led up to the gates of the fortress. Spies, Curic grunted.
How do you know that? Sparhawk asked.
Look at the way they're laying the cobblestones, Sparhawk. They haven't got the faintest idea of what they're doing.
It does look a bit slipshod, doesn't it? Sparhawk agreed, looking critically at the section of newly laid stone as they rode past the unseeing road gang.
Annius must be getting old, Curic said. He never used to be this obvious.
He's got a lot on his mind, I guess.
They clattered up the road to the drawbridge, and then on across it and into the courtyard, passing the indifferent quartet of armored knights on guard at the gate. A young novice was drawing water from the well in the center of the courtyard, laboriously winding the creaking windlass mounted at the well mouth. With a final little flourish, Flute took her pipes from her lips. The novice choked out a startled oath and reached for his sword. The windlass squealed as the bucket plummeted down again.
Easy, brother, Sparhawk told him, dismounting.
How did you get past the gate? The novice exclaimed.
You wouldn't believe it, Curic told him, swinging down from his gelding's back.
Forgive me, Sir Sparhawk, the novice stammered. You startled me.
It's all right, Sparhawk assured him.
Did Calton get back yet?
Yes, my lord. He and the knights from the other orders arrived some time back.
Good. Do you know where I might find them?
I believe they're with Lord Vanion in his study.
Thank you. Would you see to our horses?
Of course, Sir Sparhawk.
They entered the chapter house and went down the central corridor toward the south end of the building. Then they climbed the narrow flight of stairs to the tower.
Sir Sparhawk, one of the young knights on guard at the top said respectfully, I'll advise Lord Vanion that you've arrived.
Thank you, brother, Sparhawk said. The knight tapped on the door, then opened it.
Sir Sparhawk is here, my lord, he reported to Vanion.
It's about time, Sparhawk heard Colton's voice inside the room.
Please go in, Sir Sparhawk, the young knight said, stepping aside and bowing.
Vanion sat at the table. Colton, Bavier, Euleth, and Tinian had risen from their seats and come forward to greet Sparhawk and the others. Bayrit and Talon sat on a bench in the corner.
When did you get in? Sparhawk asked as Colton roughly clasped his hand.
Early last week, the blond man replied.
What kept you?
We had a long way to go, Colton, Sparhawk protested. Wordlessly, he gripped the hands of Tinian, Euleth, and Bavier. Then he bowed to Vanion.
My lord, he said.
Sparhawk? Vanion nodded.
Did you get my messages?
If there were only two, I did.
Good. Then you're fairly well up to date on what's going on down there.
Vanion, however, was looking closely at Sophronia.
You're not looking too well, little mother, he said.
I'll be all right, she said, passing one hand wearily across her eyes.
Sit down, Colton said, holding a chair for her.
Thank you.
What happened in Dabur, Sparhawk? Vanion asked, his eyes intent.
We found that physician, Sparhawk reported. As it turns out, he did in fact cure some people who'd been poisoned with the same thing Annius gave the queen.
Thank God, Vanion said, letting his breath out explosively.
Don't be too quick about that, Vanion, Sophronia told him. We know what the cure is, but we've got to find it before we can use it.
I don't quite follow you.
The poison is extremely potent. The only way to counteract it is through the use of magic.
Did the physician give you the spell he used?
Apparently there's no spell involved. There are a number of objects in the world that have enormous power. We have to find one of them.
He frowned.
That could take time, he said. People usually hide those things to keep them from being stolen.
I know.
Are you absolutely certain you've identified the right poison? Colton asked Sparhawk.
Sparhawk nodded.
I got confirmation from Martell, he said.
Martell? You actually gave him time to talk before you killed him?
I didn't kill him. The time wasn't right.
Any time is right for that, Sparhawk.
I felt that way myself when I first saw him. But Sophronia persuaded the two of us to put away our swords.
I'm terribly disappointed in you, Sophronia, Colton said.
You almost had to have been there to understand, she replied.
Why didn't you just get whatever it was the physician used to cure those other people? Tinian asked Sparhawk.
Because he ground it to a powder, mixed it with wine, and had them drink it. Is that the way it's supposed to be done? No, as a matter of fact, it's not. Sophronia spoke to him rather sharply about that. I think you'd better start at the beginning, Vanion said. Right, Sparhawk agreed, taking a chair. Briefly, he told them about Arasham's holy talisman, and about the ploy that had gotten them into the old man's tent. You are being awfully free with the name of my king, Sparhawk, Tinian objected. We don't necessarily need to tell him about it, do we? Sparhawk replied. I needed to use the name of a kingdom a long way from Rendor. Arasham probably has only the vaguest idea of where Daera is. Why didn't you say you were from Thalasia, then? I doubt if Arasham's ever heard of Thalasia. Anyway, the holy talisman turned out to be a fake. Martell was there, and he was trying to persuade the old lunatic to postpone his uprising until the time of the election of the new archprelate. He went on to describe the means by which he had overturned the white-haired man's scheme. My friend, Calton said admiringly, I'm proud of you. Thank you, Calton, Sparhawk said modestly. It did turn out rather well, I thought. He's been patting himself on the back ever since we came out of Arasham's tent, Sophronia said. She looked at Vanion. Kerris died, she told him sadly. Vanion nodded, his face somber. I know, he said. How did you find out? His ghost came to us to deliver his sword to Sophronia, Sparhawk told him. Vanion, we're going to have to do something about that. She can't go on carrying all those swords and everything they symbolize. She gets weaker every time somebody gives her another one. I'm all right, Sparhawk, she insisted. I hate to contradict you, little mother, but you're definitely not all right. It's all you can do right now to hold up your head. About two more of those swords is all it's going to take to put you on your knees. Where are the swords now? Vanion asked. We brought a mule with us, Kirik replied. They're in a box in his pack. Would you get them for me, please? Right away, Kirik said, going to the door. What have you got in mind, Vanion? Sophronia asked suspiciously. I'm going to take the swords, he shrugged, and everything that goes with them. You can't. Oh, yes, I can, Sophronia. I was in the throne room, too, and I know which spell to use. You don't have to be the one who has to carry them. Any one of us who was there can do it. You're not strong enough, Vanion. When you get down to it, I could carry you and everything you've got in your arms, my teacher, and right now you're more important than I am. But, she started. He held up his hand. The discussion is ended, Sophronia. I am the preceptor. With or without your permission, I'm taking those swords away from you. You don't know what it means, my dearest one. I won't let you. Her face was suddenly wet with tears, and she wrung her hands in an uncharacteristic display of human emotion. I won't let you. You can't stop me, he said in a gentle voice. I can cast the spell without your help if I have to. If you want to keep your spells a secret, little mother, you shouldn't chant them out loud, you know. You should know by now that I've got a very retentive memory. She stared at him. I'm shocked at you, Vanion, she declared. You were not so unkind when you were young. Life is filled with these little disappointments, isn't it? He said urbanely. I can stop you, she cried, still wringing her hands. You forget just how much stronger I am than you are. There was a shrill triumph in her voice. Of course you are. That's why I'd have to call in help. Could you deal with 10 knights all chanting in unison? Or 50? Or 50,000? That's unfair, she exclaimed. I did not know that you would go this far, Vanion, and I trusted you. And well you should, dear one, he said, assuming suddenly the superior role, for I will not permit you to make this sacrifice. I'll force you to submit to me because you know I'm right. You'll release the burden to me because you know that what you have to do is more important than anything else right now, and you'll sacrifice anything to do what we both know must be done. Dear one, she began in an agonized voice, my dearest one, as I said, he cut her off, the discussion is ended. There was a long and awkward silence as Sophronia and Vanion stood with their eyes locked on each other's faces. Did the physician in Dabur give you any hints about which objects might cure the queen? Xavier asked Sparhawk a bit uneasily. He mentioned a spear in Darasia, several rings in Zamok,
a bracelet somewhere in Pelosia, and a jewel on the royal crown of Thalesia. Euloth grunted. The Belium. That solves it, then, Galton said. We go to Thalesia, borrow Worgen's crown, and come back here with it. Worgen doesn't have it, Euloth told him. What do you mean Worgen doesn't have it? He's the king of Thalesia, isn't he? That crown was lost 500 years ago. Could we possibly find it? Almost anything is possible, I suppose, the big Thalesian replied. But people have been looking for it for 500 years without much success. Do we have that kind of time? What is this Belium? Finian asked him. The legends say that it's a very large sapphire, carved in the shape of a rose. It's supposed to have the power of the troll gods in it. Does it? I wouldn't know. I've never seen it. It's lost, remember? There are bound to be other objects, Sophronia declared. We live in a world with magic all around us. In all of the eons since the beginning of time, I'd imagine that the gods have seen fit to create any number of things with the kind of power we're looking for. Why not just make one? Galton asked. Get a group of people together and have them cast a spell on something, some jewel or stone or ring or whatever. Now I can see why you never became proficient in the secrets, Galton, Sophronia sighed. You don't even understand the basic principles. All magic comes from the gods, not from us. They allow us to borrow, if we ask them in the proper fashion. But they won't let us make the kind of thing we're looking for in this case. The power that's instilled in those objects is a part of the power of the gods themselves, and they don't sacrifice that sort of thing lightly. Oh, the blonde man said. I didn't know that. You should have. I told you about it when you were 15. I must have forgotten. About all we can do is start looking, Vanion said. I'll send word to the other preceptors. We'll have every church knight in all four orders working on it. And I'll get word to the Styrix in the mountains, Sophronia added. There are many such things known only to Styricum. Did anything interesting happen in Mardell? Sparhawk asked Galton. Not really, Galton replied. We caught a few glimpses of Kroger, but always from a distance. By the time we got close to where he'd been, he'd given us the slip. He's a tricky little weasel, isn't he? Sparhawk nodded. That's what made me finally realize that he was being used as bait. Could you get any idea of what he was doing? No, we could never get close enough. He was up to something, though. He was scurrying around Mardell like a mouse in a cheese factory. Did Addis drop out of sight? More or less. Talon and Bayrit saw him once, when he and Kroger rode out of town. Which way were they going? Sparhawk asked the boy. Talon shrugged. They were headed back toward Barata the last time we saw them, he said. They might have changed direction once they got out of sight, though. The big one had some bandages on his head, Sir Sparhawk, Bayrit reported, and his arm was in a sling. Galton laughed. It seems that you got a bigger piece of him than either one of us realized, Sparhawk, he said. I was trying, Sparhawk said grimly. Getting rid of Addis is one of my main goals in life. The door opened and Curic came back in, carrying the wooden case containing the swords of the fallen knights. You insist on doing this, Vanion? Sophronia asked. I don't see that there's any choice, he replied. You have to be fit to move around. I can do my job sitting down, or lying in bed, or dead, probably, if it comes to that. End of side 9. To continue, turn the cassette over.